Welcome and good morning, everyone. In this concurrent session, we have two very experienced actuaries, Karen Liao and Jeff Humphreys, speaking to us on the topic of insurance in super, optimizing a dignified retirement for all members. We have about 45 minutes. I think it's only 42 now. 30 minutes for the presentation and about 10 minutes for our Q&As afterwards. So please use your Q&A the app to get your questions through throughout the presentation. I will do a quick introduction. I'll just pass the mic straight to you guys. Karen is currently the general manager of Actuarial Service at Rest, a super fund that supports 2 million Australians. She oversees the insurance pricing, reserving, and guiding the development of tailored, affordable insurance solutions. Karen brings two decades of actuarial experience in financial services, spanning not just insurance, but in banking, superannuation, risk management, as well as trustee and regulatory affairs. But more importantly, outside of work, Karen lives and works from a farm in her coastal New South Wales property. She enjoys the simple pleasure of the farm life, caring for a range of farm animals. I understand that she is, you're currently learning how to ride a donkey?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Awesome. And Jeff is the principal of CHR Consulting. He is an actuary with 20 years of experience consulting to group risk and superannuation clients. Jeff is also a veteran when it comes to presenting at Actuary Summit. So I'd like to take the opportunity just to call out a couple of the previous presentations you've done. Not all of them, but I think there's a long list. So in 2017, Jeff presented on the topic Group Insurance Structure of the Future. In 2022, he presented on the topic Mental Health and Natural Experience. And during the 2023 International Congress of Actuary, with a global audience, he presented on the topic of Sex is Overrated. I'll let him explain that himself. On that note, I'll pass the mic to Jeff.
Yeah. Oh, fortunately, this one's about dignified retirement. So dignified retirement, the word dignified actually comes out of the objective of super legislation, and we've cherry-picked that because it's very important. And the other important thing about the objective of super legislation is that it recognises the importance of group insurance and recognises it not just because people might die, but also because they might have interrupted work patterns. So that's very important that we have a legislated regime that's supporting us. So I'm going to talk a bit mainly about the background to start off with. You know, what is the risk faced by the member? Some other background issues. And then what are the issues for members? Then Karen will go on and talk about the nitty-gritty stuff, the hard actuarial. I think we have a 2-star rating here today of difficulty. And I'll come in at the end about the optimising, what are some of the things we can do that aren't being done. And as actuaries, we'll be asked for our advice at times, hopefully, by the trustees. Not always taken, but we'll be asked for our advice. And hopefully there is a better methodology than is currently in place. So this is a number that the Insurance and Super Subcommittee put its mind to. If you're starting off as an 18-year-old and you're going to work through to age 67, what's the probability of having a claim? Income protection, TPD, death. So, and we looked at claim rates and we verified that with premium rates. And on best estimate basis, we came up with 30%. So we got 30% of the 18-year-olds will experience some form of claim. And that's a risk I don't think that perhaps the industry understands. So when you talk to trustees, insurance is a minor thing because not many people claim. In fact, quite a few people, when they're starting their career, will end up having a claim. And we'll all have known people, possibly, I certainly have, who have died before they've got the 67. There's assist legislation. I put it here. It basically formulates that the trustee has to do a balancing act. How much insurance am I going to provide and is that cost appropriate? So I'm not going to read all that out. We're probably all familiar with it. And there's the balancing act. You've got 30% will claim, 70% who don't. Trustee has to resolve the balance. There's a lot of reasons why insurance and super is important. I mean, insurance in its own right provides peace of mind. The insurance and super is quite affordable, particularly as I mentioned in the next slide, I think it's a buy now, pay later scheme. You pay with your retirement income, but you get the benefit during your working life. obviously provides financial protection. It gives the community a bit of a safety net, and it's a lot more accessible perhaps than retail. So for a lot of occupations, there's a lot better access. I remember when I was and I still am the actuary to the air traffic controllers, and they were told they couldn't have insurance. End of story. And yet we insured all of them, and their rates were really good. Right, but when you look up the actuarial textbook, that's an example of accessibility. As I said, it's a buy now, pay later scheme. Yes, it's fixed. You're going to pay your 12% from 1 July. You're going to put that in, and that's gone. The insurance part doesn't actually impact your salary. What are some of the issues for members? So there is in our industry an emphasis on the erosion covenant over the needs-based covenant. That's an issue for members because we're dumbing down the benefits over time. So benefits are losing their value. Not just because some funds are dialing down, for example, the benefit period in IP, but also because the industry funds who provide dollar benefits aren't increasing those with wage rises or inflation. So some funds have still got the same design they had back in the mid-2019s. And we have inadequate member education and member tools. I think also there's a lack of transparency amongst the trustees. They don't explain why they've set their default to the level they've set it. So a member can't compare their situation to the default member that has determined their design. So there's a lack of transparency there. That might be in their IMF, but their IMF, their insurance management framework, will be a hidden document, untouched by human eyes. And then we have poor insurance calculators. So we have a look at the calculators. They're not very, very useful for a member. I've got some of the problems they have. In a lot of cases, the member actually nominates how long their loss is going to be. So that if you put in, I need income for 2 years if my partner dies, that's the answer you'll get, 2 years times something. Right? If you put in 20 years, you'll get 20 times something. I mean, that is just about useless. There's a poor description for the member of what is meant by salary. Is it pre-tax or post-tax? Same with expenditure. Is it household expenditure or is it the expenditure that you contribute to in that household? A lot of them are over complex. Some of them have no income protection benefit included. Some of them just set the disability cover equal to the death cover, which, intuitively that can't be right because you've still got a person living who's disabled. And some of them provide a whole stack of cover for singles. And they're inconsistent. So what we did here was put through a few profiles by age, salary, and family status. And if you look at the top left-hand graph, for example, there's six funds here. Not all funds will let you use their calculator unless you're a member. Six funds here. And if you take, for example, low salary, medium salary, high salary, very high salary. Right, there's one, age 25, 35, 45, 55, then we do it again, then we do it again, then we do it again. And you see one fund saying, I'm a single person, I need over $1 million of death cover.
Right,
ridiculous. Yeah, all the other funds are pretty well spot on, the answer's about zero. Right, and you'll see that same fund appears on the right-hand side, really high levels of cover. That calculator is written by an insurance broker. Other calculators are either written by the fund or by the fund's insurer. But the point here is, even if you exclude this outlier, there's an enormous variety of answers. So if I'm a member and I just feed into any of the funds, I can get any amount of sum insured I need. This is just death cover, which is fairly straightforward. If you look at disability cover, you get the same problem. You've just got this enormous variety of answers. So from members' point of view, the industry, if we call this the industry view of what a person should have, we've got no consistency. The only good things we do have, though, are The answers do go down with age, and they do go up with salary. So salary being what you're really losing if you die on a death or a disability, you're losing salary. That's your indemnity basis. They do go up with salary. They do go down with age because, you know, the present value of your loss is smaller. But they're inconsistent between funds. Some of them are intuitively wrong. So really they're of little value to members. So that's another member issue. And if you go to the ASIC website, Money Smart, it does death cover, but it won't give you any advice on disability cover, which is quite a deficiency. It's more calculator than guidance tool. So again, it's one of the ones where you feed in how long you're going to need the money for. So out comes the answer. I mean, you might as well just put it in a spreadsheet. So it's very dependent on the member input. And so the ASIC calculator is really of no use to the member either. A couple of misconceptions in the industry, not perhaps amongst actuaries, but just generally. Members who don't claim are subsidising members who do. We've heard this. I don't know if other people here have heard it. I've heard that from a product person who's been in insurance for a while. So no understanding of what insurance is, when in fact every member faces a risk. It's a pretty well the same risk. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty well the same risk, and it's pretty well unknown. And what the trustees or the super funds are doing is providing us access to a pool, and that pooling is sharing the financial risk that we all face. Percentage of members claiming is very small. Well, IWSC, Insurance and Super Subcommittee, doesn't think that's the case. 30% of members face this risk over their working life. And premium is an expense. The actual expense isn't the premium, because most of the premium in group insurance goes back as benefits. So it's the pooling effect. There is an insurer margin. Of course, it's stamp duty, there's expenses, and there's capital cost. But the premium itself is not an expense, even though in the industry people will call it the whole of the premium an expense.
So now that you, Jeff spoke a bit about the issues facing members in terms of the insurance, not enough education or understanding about insurance. Therefore, there is a lot of challenges facing members in terms of exercising an informed choice, and the calculators are not helpful. So where is the safety net then? The safety net for most members, therefore, it sits on the default insurance that they have. So let's have a look at the default insurance. But before we go there, let's talk about how much insurance is needed. This is a million-dollar question. Before we get there, let's have a talk about indemnity. So what is indemnity-based insurance design? Indemnity-based insurance design is fundamental to many insurance contracts. It is based on the very fundamental key principle of restoring financial position of someone who has had an insured event. It's not trying to make someone richer. It's trying to restore the same financial position. So we need, in which case, it is about compensating the financial loss of the member. Why is it important? It is important because it makes sure the members don't gain financially from an insurance claim. Therefore, it could encourage moral hazard and fraudulent behavior. So a lot of you will know, we will hear about expenditure-based design. So as I know, many trustees would be designing their insurance based on how much member needs to pay off their mortgage, to spend on education for our kids. But what we're talking about here today is about indemnity. So why indemnity instead of expenditure-based? There are a lot of pros and cons, a lot of pros for indemnity. Firstly, indemnity is very easy for the trustee to calculate. It's basically a percentage of salary. It is simple and it is known. There is a lower risk of moral hazard, and then it ensures a continuation of a standard of living of the member post an insured event. Very importantly, indemnity is based on income replacement. When somebody dies or becomes disabled, their expenditure doesn't change. They still have to pay off their mortgage. They still have kids, the same. But what has changed is that their salary is now lost. Therefore, indemnity-based insurance is designed on salary, not expenditure. Expenditure, on the other hand, has higher risk of moral hazard. It has a higher chance of over and under insurance. And very importantly, it's actually almost impossible for the trustee to estimate the expenditure for their members. There's such a wide range of different profiles of members and different life living standards. So for the purpose of this analysis, what we're going to do today, how much insurance do members need? We use indemnity-based insurance to design the need of members. Yeah. Okay, so how does it work if we use indemnity-based insurance design? So as I mentioned before, indemnity-based insurance design is income-based. So for death, it's the financial loss of the member, right? It's a lost salary and super until the retirement age or until the deceased spouse repartners or remarries. When they remarry or repartner, the household income becomes whole again. So we don't necessarily want to insure them for the lifetime until retirement age. We just have to think about when does the household income become whole again. For disability, it is the financial loss of salary and super until retirement age. I'll come back to the retirement age. And there's also any additional financial losses like excess medical expenses, retraining costs, or any adjustment cost to disability. Now, I'm going to ask you guys a question. So if you can raise your hands for me, how many of you owns a house? Okay, good. How many of you have house insurance? Oh, not all of you. and how many of you, let's say it cost you $1 million to rebuild your home. How many of you insure the value to $1 million? Oh, okay. What about 80% of $1 million? Okay, so not all of you insured all to the full value. But anyway, I would, if it cost me $1 million to build my house, I will insure to that value because that's a worst case scenario. Even though you may not use that full value because the chances of doing that is of losing the whole value of the house is obviously not as much as if you only need to claim a few thousand dollars here and there. But anyway, I would still insure to the full maximum loss. Therefore, for income protection as well, the maximum loss is if you become permanently disabled. So for the purpose of this designing insurance, we do need to look at the maximum loss. And then the premium obviously will reflect accordingly based on the risk of that maximum loss. Therefore, this is why we look at the permanent disability when we look at disability design. Okay, hang on. Going back. So how do we then, using this concept, to apply a practical example of using indemnity-based insurance to design our insurance? So for death, we have assumed 5 times lost salary. Because why 5? Because it takes about 3 to 4 years for someone to repartner or remarry, and we adjust for tax, and we allow for some level of adjust for tax, yes. And then we get about 5 times, roughly 5 times of salary, and before the family household income becomes whole again. For disability, it's obviously the 75% of lost salary, 75% being the maximum insurability, plus the loss of super contributions. And we've assumed $100,000 of excess medical cost and readjustment cost. And then to retrain them into a different profession, the cost we have assumed $35,000. So if we use this design to apply it to an Australian working population, so we have gone to search the data and stuff. We look at what is an average Australian with a couple with 2 children with an income, a median income and median account balance. How much insurance do this person need? So let's call this person Mr. Bob. How much does Mr. Bob need? Mr. Bob will need, if he's 18 years old, obviously he doesn't need as much, but if he is 30, between 30 and 50-ish, the prime ages, he needs about $360,000 of death cover. And as you know, as Bob gets older, his requirement for insurance reduces as the salary reduces or the financial commitments reduce because the dependents have grown up. And then their super balance has increased, so it reduces with age until they're 67. Okay, so let's look at disability. For someone who becomes disabled, how much does Mr. Bob need to be covered to make sure that income is whole, up to 75% of income, obviously, between the prime ages of 28 to, say, I don't know, 40, 42, they need about $1.7 million of cover, which is a lot. And also, as you know, when they grow older, the exposure, time exposure to retirement reduces with time, therefore the drop in the need. Now, how much cover is provided in the industry right now? Have a guess. On average, how much do you think a member is covered for a death cover? 80%? 50%? 80,000? Okay. Let's have a look. You might know the answer. So there is a lot of information here. I'm just going to walk you through it quickly. The red line is what you saw just now. The dotted red line is the bottom quartile salary, right? Not the median, the bottom quartile, which is like the poor people. And then the blue line, the blue lines are the seven largest industry funds in the super funds right now. And on average, it's a very thick blue line, is how much they're offering. So as you can see, the coverage they're getting is only about 50% across all ages, if you earn a median income. And then if you look at the gray line, that's the poverty line. If you offer cover less than that, members are at significant risk of financial exposure and financial hardship and potentially exposed to significant poverty. So that's for death. For disability, the difference is even with starker. So we have the red line and the poverty line and then the lower quartile line, which is similar to the poverty line. So when we look at disability, we actually look at the present value of the TPD cover and then the present value of all the IP cover members get for default. As you know, many funds don't even offer IP cover. And when they do, they offer up to a maximum of 5 years as a default. That's why, as you can see here, the coverage for members is significantly very, very low compared to how much they need. And the coverage is only about 10% of how much a member needs. Even when you compare to the poverty line, if someone becomes permanently disabled, which is about 7% of the risk. If we talk about 30% just now, 7% of members could become permanently disabled. So you can see that there is a significant gap there. So a lot of members, Australians, are very financially exposed to disability and at risk of severe financial hardship and poverty. The next one is coming back to the same graph, but we have added additional analysis on how much do members apply for voluntary cover to try to cover the gap. So we looked at 75,000 data points, so applications that came in. How much total cover do they ask for? They ask for about just under 1 million on the prime ages. So significantly higher than how much is offered in the market, even higher than the indemnity full base cover. And we suspect it's higher than that. It's because members probably using calculators that give them different results. We don't know at this stage, but that's just a guess. Very importantly also, the shape of the how much member asks for cover is the same as the indemnity cover. So that's for death. For disability, members, the green line is how much members apply for cover voluntary. Again, it is over a data point of 69,000 data points. It's a lot. So we can see that how much members actually apply for significantly higher cover than what is offered in the default, from the default insurance. And members are not applying up to the maximum of what the red line there. And the reason for that is probably because there is not a lot of IP cover out there that offers a long-term income protection. That's why even if they do increase the cover amount, they couldn't meet that gap of having that long-term cover. Yeah. Okay, so we've spoken about how much insurance is needed by members. Now let's talk about the other side of the coin. How much does insurance cost? It's another million-dollar question, because everybody talk about insurance is eroding your income, you shouldn't have too much insurance, and what does it do to your retirement savings? It's going to disappear. Let's have a look at the answer for that. Before that, we need to talk about how do we measure insurance costs. There are many ways we can measure it. We've spoken about salary, which is what was used before, percentage of account balance, and yada, yada, yada. Actually, one of them is there were also something that has been used quite widely as well, is super funds tend to try to compare with each other and benchmarking. We'll talk a bit more about that later. But what we found is the best way of measuring cost of insurance is the percentage of retirement income. It ticks all the boxes. It's aligned with the legislation. It can be tailored to members' demographic. It looks at the long-term measure, and it's simple for members to understand. Okay, so if you insure yourself today for 40 years when you're working, how much income are you going to lose when you retire in 40 years' time? So that's easy for members to understand. Talking about benchmarking, when you design your insurance, you shouldn't benchmark. Well, it's not right to benchmark against other funds. Look at what other funds are doing. As we can see from the previous graphs, most funds have the sum insured very close together. So there is a bit of a herd mentality going on there. So it is a suboptimal method because it is inconsistent with the CSAT and yet it's used by many funds, and it's the herd mentality. It doesn't address what member really needs, because we need to design our insurance that's tailored to the membership of each fund, and every membership is different. So again, coming back to how do we measure insurance cost? Firstly, alignment with legislation. Secondly, it allows for the three pillars of retirement funding, which include the age pension, which is very important, and also the time period. It look at the overall working lifetime of a member. So by using the cost of insurance as a total premium as a percentage of retirement income, it tick all the boxes for those three. Okay, so this is the answer to the question. So how much, if you give members a full insurance, which is what we discussed before, the indemnity-based insurance, how much is the erosion? 11% of their retirement income. And how much these days the funds offering under the default cover, on average, it's the blue bar, it's 2.2%. And if we use a 1% of salary, what's the erosion? That is 4.1%. So that 11% on the first bar, it equates to $5,500 a year. So if you earn $50,000, you lose about $5,500 of income a year by having a protection, insurance protection over the lifetime of 40 years. So doesn't sound like disastrous. Well, we look at it, how does it change your lifestyle? If you lose that 10%, $5,500, are you going to live in poverty? So we had a look at ASFA comfortable income versus modest and poverty. We can see that if you don't have insurance, you have about $50,000 of annual income. If you have the full insurance cover for 40 years, your income is still above the ASFA comfortable level. It is a bit less, but you're still comfortable. But if you have the industry default insurance, it barely scratched the surface. Even the 1% of salary, you wouldn't notice a difference in your living standard. So that's what we found. So the key question is, based on this analysis, we answered the very two key questions: how much insurance do members need? And how much does it cost? So I'm going to pass it over to Jeff, who will talk a little bit more about the third point here.
I'll quickly go into a question and then pass it to Jeff after that, because there's one question. I'm surprised that you got one live, but I thought was quite interesting. The question says, does your death insurance needs cover the cost of Tinder and other dating apps subscriptions repartnering?
Sorry, again.
does it cover the need of the cost of Tinder?
Oh, no.
There is a serious answer to that question, actually.
I was going to say, how much does Tinder cost?
I understand that the assumption that you used was that it typically takes like 3 or 4 years for someone to remarry. And that was based on like early in the century. With the introduction of Tinder and the modern lifestyle, with this 3 or 4 years might actually be a lot longer, so that should be a consideration to the derivation.
Yeah. Yes, or there's no need to remarry. Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, dear.
That was a bit strange, wasn't it? Okay. So let's get back to the exciting stuff. So there's some really good information on this slide. This is a key takeaway, this slide, to my way of thinking. That's key because, firstly, you've got that light grey. See all that light grey stuff at the bottom there? That's the age pension. So if I'm looking at my retirement income, I'm getting a whole stack of retirement income, regardless of what I paid for insurance. Really important point. Because the legislation doesn't say a proportion of account balance. It says a proportion of what's the inappropriate erosion of your retirement income. So your retirement income is a lot more than just what comes out of super. If you're well off, you'll put more than 12% into super. So you'll still have some sort of grey bar, even if you miss out on the age pension. So super isn't the only form of source of retirement income, obviously. Now, the other interesting thing is if you just look at the yellow bar, that's the 1% of salary. Remember the old 1% of salary disappeared in 2021? Disappeared, unfortunately. We thought it was too low, but then the funds have gone a lot lower than the 1%, as Karen showed. But just comparing that yellow bar to the dark grey bar, this is very interesting. Just the yellow bit here. Right, that's the the 1% income, and that's the no insurance income. That yellow part is 90% of the grey. And we always thought the 1% calculation that came out of that original effort by the industry to put in a voluntary code was about a 10% reduction. And that in those days, we didn't account for age pension. So it was in those days, we thought, oh, that's about a 10% reduction in retirement income. But of course, once you put in the age pension, it's only a 4% reduction. So I love this slide. It's also very important. I mean, this is all on median salaries. So half the people get more, half the people get less. And of course, it's also important to note that just because you're in a lower quartile at some point in your life doesn't mean you won't be in a higher quartile later in your life for obvious reasons. So I think it's also important just to consider the scenarios. If you're a trustee or advising a trustee, what are the scenarios? I'm going to either be, let's say the extremes are I'm insured or I'm uninsured. Right, there's an extreme. And I'm either going to get through life without claiming or I'm going to have a claim. Right. So there's four extremes. So if I just look at the healthy life, I'm healthy right through till in this case, we just say you die at 88. Right. I'm going to have the same salary, whether I'm insured or uninsured. I'm going to have a slightly different, retirement income. These are all on. I've put the assumptions there. I've allowed 3% of salary so full needs based premium cost, just a flat 50,000. This is just to show what sort of profiles people are looking at over their working and their retirement life. Okay, and this is the unhealthy life. In this case, I've assumed someone becomes disabled at age 40, permanently disabled. Right, very very simple. It's So the uninsured person happily goes along, everybody's getting the same salary, and the uninsured person, all they can do is access their account balance at that point, right? And their income is going to drop down here. The insured person, on the other hand, gets their 75% of salary, right? And the uninsured person here, when they're 67, this uninsured person has a partner who is also earning, and they're not entitled to the disability support pension because they earn too much money as a household. Just another assumption to throw in. Right. So you don't get the disability support pension if your household income is at all significant. So the insured person, of course, is still on the same retirement income as they were, whether they're healthy or unhealthy. That's what the insurance has done. But the uninsured person has just this income plus the age pension. So in retirement, they're a little bit better off, but they're still not as well off. Now, these are important profiles for a trustee to consider because we don't make the decision. We just help, unless any of you in here are trustees. We help with the decision. And so there, I've just put in the four profiles to compare them. So it seems to me you can summarise the current methods of working out the balance as, oh, well, I've got this design that I've always had. What, you know, I'll twig it here and I'll twig it there. A little bit of band-aiding, maybe a little bit of an increase, maybe a little bit of a decrease. But the big emphasis on what's everybody else doing. So premiums and sums insured, both. And that could be dollar premiums, regardless of what benefits are being provided. And then there's the 1% methodology. But I think what Karen was talking about gives us a better methodology. So establish some facts. I don't think the trustees or their management do this at the moment. Determine the indemnity cover design. It doesn't mean you're going to provide it, but if you don't know what it looks like, and you know, we'll all have a different opinion on what is an indemnity, but it'll be based on salary. And determine the cost of that. Understand the impact on retirement income. Understand the range of outcomes facing members, insured, uninsured, current design, whatever else you think is appropriate. And then you've got to determine the appropriate trade-off. So I think one thing that really helps is this sort of ask for comfortable stuff and ask for modest. So what proportion of members are going to end up under there or not under there, right? So these are healthy members. This is their outcome. The unhealthy member will be a lot better off insured, obviously, and insured for a lot. And then there's the little bit of utility theory, which I'll just go into very quickly. Utility theory, everybody here knows utility theory better than I do, but it hypothesises that where there's a trade-off, a person will maximise their utility or their satisfaction. So you have one Cornetto, fine. You have three Cornettos, some of us will be crook, some of us will be happy, but once you have nine Cornettos, you can guarantee you'll be feeling pretty bad, right? So marginal utility is decreasing. Marginal utility can go negative. And there's a limited total income or budget. There is no matter what, who you are. Maximising expected value doesn't work. And we know that. Just look at insurance. The expected value of the claims is always less than the expected, than the premium. Right. So it's not an expected value. There is something in utility theory that will help trustees. We haven't worked it out yet, but there is something in utility theory. Now, what we know is there's diminishing marginal utility applies to income. On the research that's been done, and I've put in some references there, the marginal dollar, the marginal extra dollar, is worth less than the previous dollars that you earn. And we see that, well, I've fitted that curve. It's a nice little power function. And once you've got the function, you can work out the maximisation problem. Here's some Australian data. Put together by the University of Canberra, and AMP. And that shows the life satisfaction on the x-axis, 0 to 10. 10's better. 0 is not very good, with median household income. And what you can see, very quickly, there's your diminishing marginal utility. People with a 10 were actually earning less than the people right back to 6. So we might all say, no, I want some more money, right? And maybe that's in here. But you also see the slope of the curve. Right? And it applies, interestingly, to assets. So the more wealth you've got, each additional dollar of wealth isn't worth as much as the prior dollars. And I'll just leave you with a note on the bit of research out of the Aston Bulletin, where you can have a look at a lot of the theory where these gentlemen or people could have been female looked at the optimal defined contribution pension management with financial and mortality risks. They only looked at mortality, but it's the start of something for us in terms of the maximisation problem and the trade-off.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, really like to thank Jeff and Karen for putting this insightful presentation and sharing their views on how the trustee thinks about insurance in super. There's a lot more content in their head and in the deleted slides I'll fit into the 30 minutes. Insurance in super is a pretty widely discussed topic, but I feel like there was a lot of insights in this presentation and new insights. Personally, for me, there was three things I took out of it. The first one is the balance of the 30% that claim and the 70%. Even though they don't, they get the safety net for the entire life. I know some of you guys are doing your back of the envelope calc to verify the 30%. It is tech reviewed. It is real. So I'll stop questioning it, some of you guys. Secondly, the average cost of default insurance is affordable. It is 2% of your projected retirement income. I mean, the key question is how do we make it more valuable and perhaps make some progress in addressing the under insurance problem in this country. And lastly, it's best that we have one ice cream at a time. Although that one's a bit more debatable. So we'll try to cover the two questions that we have in addition to the Tinder one that we already addressed. So the one from Matt, it's probably for either of you guys. In the indemnity-based approach to modelling disability cover required, have we allowed for the percentage of TPD claimants who in fact return to work after claim? So this is regarding the 100K and the 35K sum insured.
So the assumption is the person's permanently disabled, so they don't return back to work. For that calculation, it's a simple arithmetic calculation. So it assumes they don't return to work. But people obviously for TPD, some people do return to work, and that's quite within the rights of under the definition that the industry provides them.
Thanks.
So that's the maximum. So that's basically the maximum cover, the maximum loss of that income. So we don't really necessarily allow for any return to work.
Thanks, Kat. I've got one more here. Is the percentage of cost of retirement income metric for insurance premiums going to be introduced at rest in the next few years? Oh,
no, that's one for Karen.
We are already looking at that in our recent analysis. Instead of looking at percentage of salary, we have shifted to looking at percentage erosion of retirement income. Yes.
Probably an extension of that question for myself, to yourself. A lot of these concepts are new and it's very insurance specific. For some of your stakeholders within the superannuation funds, what are some of the approach or ways that you use to describe or try to outline some the challenges that we face, or how do you go about influencing some of the non-insurance specific stakeholders in the super fund?
So when we, as you can see in some of the graphs that we had out there, we actually compare the lifestyle, like ASFA comfortable lifestyle, and then the poverty line as well. So when we look at, we haven't got it in this one, but what the other thing that we presented to the trustee when we talk about this issue is, if members don't have insurance today and the need, the cover they have today based on the current design, what is our lifestyle going to be? And we can find that under many cases, after 2 years of disability, they are going to end up living under poverty. So when we paint a picture like that, it tells the story.
Right.
I've got a question.
Oh, yep. Alan?
I took the liberty, Michael, of standing up. Thanks, Karen. Thanks, Jeff. That was really, it's a really tough problem, and so really appreciate you bringing some light to it. The calculator things interested me because I've had a bit of a play and a look around as well. And I see two roles. One is helping members decide that default is appropriate to keep. I'm not sure how many members actually look at it, but also more importantly, how many people can say default is not enough, so I should do more. My looking at calculators seem to, and a little bit you did it, they seem to look at death, and then they look at TPD, and then they look at IP, and they don't actually look at the bundle, and actually the bundle can lead, unfortunately, to over-insurance presentations. Any comments on how we deal with that, especially given IP, for me, is actually possibly for the younger the most important cover to have, short-term IP?
Yeah, no, good question. Because one of the things we had to do there, when I produced those disability graphs, I just multiplied the benefit period by the salary that I'd assumed and said, oh, the person's going to get that for IP, add that to TPD and there's what's being recommended, just to simplify it. But they do separate those out so that they're trying to provide a solution to your disability needs by using products. Wrong way around. What do I need? How can I address that need? That they've got it round the wrong way. I mean, I wonder if ASIC should actually have a shot at doing a calculator that people can go to, that the funds refer to, and get it right. At least get it right and show you what the assumptions behind that are, and then perhaps members are able to vary it. But while we've got every fund giving us a different answer and some funds not even letting you go in and have a look, we've got big problems.
Great. I think we are out of time. Hey, it's 12:40. So if Jeff and Karen are more than happy to stay back or discuss this topic over lunch. Otherwise, yeah, please join me in thanking both of our speakers.